4th is the Senate Committee on Judiciary. It's June 29th, 1989, hearing room 343, 1:30 p.m. We have a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3470B and a work session on House Bill 2250.
We're going to wait till Brockman gets back from the can.
Oh, Brockman. No, we just lost Brockman.
Another couple of days and...
He'll be...
This wouldn't have happened.
We'd only gotten home today. Wouldn't have to worry about a lot of things.
Okay, we're going to come to order. And the subject will be relating to House Bill 2250. We have Attorney General Frohnmeyer who's come to talk about amendment, which would essentially be added to our, as a gut and stuff to deal with this bill, an issue that's come from the U.S. Supreme Court. And so, David, why don't you come, tell us what we ought to be doing, and we appreciate your willingness to dash over here at a moment's notice and get this little chore done.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Dave Frohnmeyer, Attorney General, accompanied by Virginia Linder, who is the Solicitor General of the State of Oregon. We have reserved our calendars for the balance of the time that you are in session, Madam Chair, because matters of this kind do seem to have a habit of arising in the closing hours. And this is the second issue in which a sudden decision from the United States Supreme Court has had a major impact on the action to be taken by this legislative body just within the last few months, the other, of course, being the Davis versus Michigan pension tax issue. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as the committee is undoubtedly aware, on Monday of this week, the United States Supreme Court handed down its decision in the case of Penry versus Linow. In the wake of that decision yesterday, the Oregon Supreme Court issued a series of four questions to counsel on a number of pending death penalty appeals, questioning the extent of the applicability of the doctrines announced in the Penry case to pending Oregon cases in which there has been a verdict of aggravated murder and in which the jury in the penalty phase has chosen to impose the death penalty. Because of the Penry decision, because of the fact that the Oregon scheme was modeled closely on the Texas scheme, which was previously found to be constitutional and which was found to be facially constitutional again in the Penry case, and because of the pendency of these important questions by the Oregon Supreme Court, which must be answered by our office within 2 weeks, and because we were given these questions by additional questions by Representative or Senator Hanby concerning the implications that this measure may have for the one just enacted this morning, that is the life without possibility parole measure, we consulted with at least three district attorney's offices, they being Dale Penn of Marion County, Mike Schrunk of Multnomah County, and Dale Harkelrod of Lane County, and came to the unanimous conclusion that we owed it as our duty to this legislative assembly to come to you with at least suggestions as to how a measure which was adopted overwhelmingly by public vote could be further amended in order to resolve any remaining unresolved constitutional questions, at least as they remain from the Penry decision. Forgive me for taking that introductory time, but I think that it's essential that you know how this came to us, the fact that we have had relatively few hours to develop responses. It is our judgment that legislative clarification, which involves the addition explicitly in statute of a fourth factor, that is a consideration of mitigating circumstances, which the United States Supreme Court has suggested may be constitutionally required, would be desirable by this legislative assembly in order to eliminate lack of clarity or possible concern about the reach and scope of Oregon's present capital punishment law. And with that by way of background, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce the committee to Ms. Linder again and ask her to either answer your specific questions or to address the constitutional issues as the committee sees fit.
Thank you. Are there questions of Dave? Thanks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Virginia Linder, Solicitor General of the State of Oregon. The proposed amendments before you would essentially change the statute in two respects, both of which in one way or another address the questions that the Oregon Supreme Court has directed to the counsel in death penalty cases. The first change would be to codify what the U.S. Supreme Court has added to the sentencing deliberation by way of judicial pronouncement. The advantage we think of codifying that is that it is more beneficial to have it in the statute if it is judicially required, and to have it there for the guidance of the trial court as the cases are actually tried. The language we've chosen is, as best we can, a model of what the U.S. Supreme Court really has said in its decision in Penry. Essentially, it would require a fourth question or issue to be submitted to the jury in those circumstances where the Constitution requires that some other factor related to a defendant's background, character, the circumstances of the offense mitigate against a sentence of death, but that factor is not otherwise encompassed within the three issues that have always statutorily been required. We made one other change that is really in the nature of a housekeeping change. Underneath that fourth question, which is sub D on page one, we've moved a standard that used to be in the second issue. The second issue used to require the jury to decide the question of a defendant's dangerousness in the future, and then read, in considering this issue, the jury shall consider all mitigating circumstances, including but not limited to, and then a series of those are enumerated in the statute. We moved that section just as a housekeeping matter down to the end, because the Oregon Supreme Court has already construed that language to apply to all of the issues. And it makes it clear if, in fact, you move it to the end of the issues and relate it back to all four.
So that is not a substantive change?
It is not a substantive change of the law as it stands, but you have to look to the judicial decisions to find it. The other provision that we've added is a new section to the statute that essentially addresses the question that the Oregon Supreme Court has addressed to us, and that is, what is the remedy if a court reverses on an error that occurred in the sentencing phase only? To date, that is a question that I think counsel on both sides in death penalty cases has given some thought to, but we haven't had occasion to brief it for the court. Their questions to us ask us to brief it for the first time, and in anticipation of trying to come up with a remedy, we've proposed one that we think is fairly close to what probably applies under the current statute and ultimately would provide for substantial savings in these cases. There are two choices under the current statute. You can either retry the entire case, including the guilt phase, which is enormously expensive, or you potentially could enter a sentence of life imprisonment. The option that our current sentencing scheme does not provide for is to impanel a new sentencing jury, because the way our statute reads requires the same jury that decided the question of guilt to decide the question of what sentence should be imposed. Several states, including Arkansas and if some of my informal information is correct, Texas, have attempted to address that and allow for the impaneling of a new sentencing phase jury so that you do not have to completely recreate the entire trial if the court found no problem with the conviction itself. And that's what this provision would permit.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Hill?
Yes. I'm trying to, in looking at this procedure where you impanel a new sentencing jury. It says that you provide a transcript. It says you can, as I believe I've read, you can recall any witness that was in the trial phase. I mean, it sounds like you're going to be getting to the point of trying the whole case almost all over again. And I guess I'm trying to see what are we limiting this to sentencing, or if you can, you're going to have a, if you can call any witness, it seems as though you could almost end up trying the whole case all over again. Is that what this contemplates?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, the statute as it currently reads does provide some limitations on the sentencing process so that you don't duplicate redundant evidence and that kind of thing in the sentencing phase. We're not trying to do away with any of that. The purpose of permitting the transcript or the exhibits to come in is precisely so that the parties don't necessarily have to call any of the actual witnesses if the transcript is adequate for that purpose. We did not want to cut off the right of either the state or the defendant to call actual witnesses if they thought credibility or matters of that kind were important to put before the jury. But the statute governing the sentencing phase generally does basically require that the evidence that you consider at sentencing be relevant to the issues that the jury has to consider. Potentially at the guilt phase, you might have a much broader evidentiary hearing before the jury because there may be many issues that you really don't need to litigate at the sentencing phase. The best example I can give you is in our first capital case in Oregon, Mr. Wagner's case, he did plead guilty, and then the sentencing phase proceeded from there. I think it's probably fair to say that based on the evidence that both sides had to produce during the sentencing phase, had they also had to try the issue of guilt, there would have been a broader record. But once guilt's established, sometimes the nature of the issues narrows so that it isn't so broad. Maybe a shorter way to answer your question is we're not sure how much we can gain, but we think there is a savings. The alternative, if we can't impanel a new jury, is to force prosecutors in many instances to go back through the guilt phase of the trial as well.
It would seem, Madam Chair, it would seem as though that to avoid, given time constraints and the constraints of expense and so forth, that it would, if prejudicial error is found in sentencing, it seems as though it would almost encourage district attorneys not to want to go back through all of this and basically leave it at a life sentence. I mean, because it seems as though this process could get pretty cumbersome. It says either party may recall any witness who testified at the prior trial or the sentencing proceedings. And I mean, if a defense counsel, even if just to avoid some indication of malpractice, might feel that they will just try to bring everybody back to just try to establish in any way possible that life should be given instead of the death penalty. I mean, I think you'd be asking them to go back through a pretty cumbersome process, and I don't see how that would favor the prosecution at all.
Well, Mr. Chairman, or Madam Chair, and Senator Hill, it's not clear at all that this would favor the prosecution. That's really not our intention.
I know that.
Our intention is to make sure that there is the fullest and most complete opportunity to address all of the issues at the sentencing phase. And, speaking from the state's position, there would be nothing worse than to have that truncated, only to find that someone would make an incompetence of counsel argument on post-conviction so that many years after the process, the whole thing would have to come back and be retried again. So our objective is to make sure that as full and fair and complete an opportunity at the sentencing phase is opened up for the defendant as can be granted by the state. And that's really why it's this way. Now, you may be quite right that it will turn into a mini trial of the guilt phase itself, but we're trying to be as economical as possible because I'm sure you're aware of how expensive these cases are for the defense as well as the state.
Right, and I, and Dave, understand, I'm not criticizing what you have here. I'm just trying to think of, as a practical matter, what it's going to mean. And if this is what's needed to have the process to be constitutional, that's just the way that it is. It's just...
Well. Yeah, I suppose if you don't do that, you've got to start all over anyway.
That's correct.
Which, you know, if you can get halfway there with this, maybe.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? We are under call of the Senate, so I wanted to make sure that we gave Attorney General Frohmeyer an opportunity to finish and the questions to finish, so we will be in recess then. And we thank you. No, we're coming right back. We're finished with this issue with his testimony, and then we've got two more issues on the agenda today to finish up 2250 and to have some discussions about what we're going to do with the gun bill. So we are reset. We're on call. We'll be back. up on 2250, and we have heard from the Attorney General an amendment that he wants to that bill. We have in front of us a Hannah Gross version of C and Gross 1073, which is mocked up to include the Senate version and the version that Bob Durson and amendments that Bob Durson will be asking us to make that are technical in nature. Kathleen and Bob, will you come up, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
I do want to say that this is not this the substitution of the Hannah Gross version of Senate Bill 1073 for the body of 2250. Is not the Criminal Justice Council's doing nor request. It is this chair's request to expedite the work that we have to do as a committee in dealing with the Speaker's gun bill. So we have tried to to look over this bill and to bring forward to committee members the parts of the bill that seem to be compatible with the Senate version. And that's what we have also been willing to invite the Criminal Justice Council's technical amendments, and Bob's going to spend 5 minutes to go through them. Mr. Springer has a 5 o'clock meeting, but we will proceed just quickly. And if you'll just point us through the pages, I don't expect you might just mention them in general, and we'll move quickly through. They are, I understand, no policy changes.
That's correct. Madam Chair, members of the committees, the Hannah Gross copy will be the reference point. Page 2, you'll see some changes to Section 2. These are just changes to make the statute is consistent with rule so that there will be no unwanted inconsistencies. Section 4 is just a clarification to eliminate a potential ambiguity in the language. Moving to Section 6 online on page 3, you'll note some additional language changes to Sections 8 and 9. Once again, this is language intended just to eliminate potential ambiguities that have been caught. Section 7, language has just been cleaned to be more consistent in multiple sections of the bill. A new section designation has been indicated to identify responsibilities that are exclusively those of the Department of Corrections. That would be 7A on line 17. Moving to page 5, this is Section 8. It's been amended. Once again, the clarification here is minimal. It's only to indicate that subsection for the bill will apply to offenders who are sentenced under the current indeterminate sentencing system. But the new subsection 5 would be applicable to those offenders who are sentenced under the guideline system. The next change, if you turn to page 12, is an addition that does not appear on your hand engrossed copy. It will be with the LC draft amendment.
And I want to say that the LC draft is done except for some additional modifications that the Attorney General requested for the other amendment that we were considering earlier today. So we will have the Hannah Gross, the LC momentarily.
Yes.
Okay.
The only point to note is Section 18B will be added, and that section merely directs the parole board to adopt rules that will create sanctions for parole violations, which will be comparable to sanctions for post-prison supervision. This was a policy that was adopted by this committee. We're just making it more clear in this additional language. Section 20 has been the first phrase has been deleted once again to eliminate an ambiguity that had arisen. Turning to page 19, section 42A, language has been changed to reference that new section 18B, it should be 18B, Once again, this is the reference to the fact that the parole board will now be identifying the sanctions for parolees in the same terms, or same sanctions will be comparable to those used for post-prison supervision violations. Same change has been made on page 20 of that section. I believe that's it for the technical amendments. This is the only change.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kathleen Bogan, Director of the Council. I'm picking up at page 37. What I'm going to give you are a mix of technical amendments, and then there is some new language. I'm afraid we may be in another situation where I don't know what piece of paper you want to deal with. We gave you some, we weren't sure of the arrival of the LC draft, so you have, in addition to the hand and gross, three separate pieces of amendment language. It was my intention to show you where those would be inserted in the bill.
Okay.
At the top of page 37, we have added some language at line 5, which makes it clear that the amendments that are adopted to the guidelines that rank new offenses created by this legislature become effective on November 1st, 1989, so that judges will know where to sentence people for new offenses created. At line 6, there was citation to wrong sections of the Act, and that's been corrected. Section 91 of the bill is new language that was added by the House Committee. It provides that when a legislative committee is considering a bill that creates a new crime or increases a period of incarceration, that it will have before it at the time it considers the bill a prison population statement. There is a requirement for a fiscal impact statement now that includes prison beds, but my understanding is you don't see it until the bill is to be voted on the floor, and there was some desire to have it before the committees when you're considering the bills. At page 37, we are adding language, which you have before you, marked section 91A and 91B. It's a single page, single spaced amendment. This is language authorizing the council to create misdemeanor sentencing guidelines.
Okay, I want to stop you right there. This committee passed this out. I've talked with Senator Thorne. The bill is in Ways and Means, and it has reference to a Senate bill. I've talked with Senator Thorne, and he expressed the reason that he was holding it down in Ways and Means because it was unclear which Senate bill finally would, in fact, or whether it would be a House bill or however sentencing guidelines might pass. And so he suggested it was just fine for him not to have to worry about another bill. We would just put it in here, and I have already talked with him about that. So, and this committee has already passed this amendment. And it was Senate Bill what?
It was Senate Bill 1070.
Okay.
And it is our intention that that particular task have no fiscal impact on this body, that what we're going to do is look for grant money, and the grant money will be much easier to find if we can say.
I don't think there's any need to discuss it. The committee's perfectly well aware of it. Okay.
At page 38, there are some deletions of language. And
if the committee will remember, this is part of the House version that we're working from here, that we're amending in the Hannon Gross bill. So I just want to remind people that we're not, everything up to section 91 was the Senate passed version. We're now in a position of picking up some amendments that the House passed that we think are good amendments and ought to be included, or at least we're recommending to you that they be included. Okay?
The language which is stricken on page 38, I've simply prepared substitute language for it, and that's before you on another single-page, single-spaced document that is 2 pages long. It's called Section 94 and 94A. This is language that provides that every legislative session will review the amendments passed by the Guidelines Board and affirmatively approve them. It's to make the legislature's action from here on out consistent with the process that you've agreed upon for this session. That's what Section 94 would do.
94B is a section which authorizes the board to adopt amendments and to, excuse me, 94A is a cleanup of the statute that's the council's enabling legislation to make it consistent with this year's process. 94B extends that amendment process and affirmative approval into the future for future amendments. That's 94B subsection 1. Subsection 2 is the language about consulting with the Criminal Justice Council and using the same underlying principles as the guidelines themselves. Subsection 3 of that section makes a reference to sections 84 and 89 of the Act. Those were, section 89 is the language that allows the board, in the event that there is some overutilization or underutilization threatened in terms of prison space, to make amendments to the guidelines that are effective immediately. That's section 89. Section 84 is the section which allows the board to rank new offenses that you have created and to have those go into effect immediately as well. Otherwise, any other amendments would be brought
in.
Which, by approval.
In our old sections, 84 and 89, we always assumed that they were going to happen that way anyway. So there's no change in the policy.
Madam Chair, that's true. Yes, you did.
Then when it left this committee. Okay.
Section 95 is simply a renumbering and a correction to cite the proper section of the 1987 Act that talks about approving the guidelines. At section 96, there is new language. We are, instead of directly amending the rules, suggesting that the legislature direct the board to amend the rules. And this is new language that was added by the House to the statement of purposes to say that truth in sentencing, the bold language that appears at the top of page 39, is a part of the purpose and principles which underlie the guidelines. At the bottom of page 39, we're renumbering section 38. And again, this is new language that was inserted.
You mean 98?
Excuse me, 98. This is, again, rather than amending the rule, we're suggesting that you direct the board to amend the rule. This was language that was inserted by the House that had to do with how criminal histories would be calculated. Under the version that you all produced, convictions of any offendant up until the time a new crime is created are the convictions that count towards the criminal history score. The House made a change in that and said that the convictions that could count are any convictions that occur in the time between the crime itself and the time that crime is sentenced. So there would be a window there when a person might be convicted of other crimes. The House wanted those crimes to be counted in the criminal history score. It isn't apparent that that change would have very much of an effect under current practices. If current practices as to charging changed, it might have an effect. But this is new language. It was not in the version that was produced by the Senate. Madam Chair, would you like me to go on?
Yes.
Okay. Section 41, page 41 of the bill. Section 101, again, this is a change made to the rule relating to departures. It clarifies some language and is a good improvement. We're suggesting, again, that rather than amending the rule, you direct the board to do so. And the clarifying language is at lines 40 and 41. It has to do with how you would calculate persistent involvement in similar offenses. We want to make it clear that when a consecutive sentence is being imposed, that behavior has to relate to something other than those cases being sentenced consecutively. At page 45 of the bill, section 106 was in your original version. Let me see what this is.
Yeah, we're pretty much through.
This section, it only is a technical amendment that did appear in your original bill. They just moved, LC just moved it to this position in the bill because of the other changes.
It eliminated, I believe, a reference to temporary leave.
Yes.
Then, the next thing that I want to point out to you is on page 58. The emergency clause needs to be renumbered, and then you have before you some additional new language, which would be a final new section to the bill.
B-19.
It's called, it's called Future Enhancements B-19. I'm sorry.
Okay.
What this language provides is that in the future, if there are correctional resources beyond those that are necessary for these guidelines to be implemented, and that's the additional 1,200 beds beyond the 500-bed medium prison, that if there are available correctional resources beyond that figure and beyond whatever you all determine is a reasonable margin of resources for management purposes, that
okay. Any other questions on this matter? Jack?
I have heard, I don't know. Is it true that because Danish is refusing to take people on voluntary commitments because there's no room, that people are sometimes going the civil commitment route instead as an alternative to a voluntary commitment?
Madam Chair, Mr. Morris, as the Attorney General that provides legal services to Danish State Hospital, I have heard the same thing. I do not know if that is in fact true. The people that would usually be responsible for that kind of commitment, if you do not do a voluntary commitment, would be the district attorneys.
I'd like to go ahead and move to Section 38, if anyone else. I know that Senator Springer has questions, and I might want to send for him, ask him to come up out of his conference committee if he can to discuss Section 38. He's in a conference committee someplace, I'm not sure where. Section 38, Jack, or Core, is a preemption language?
Yes.
Okay.
And this language has come about from many discussions. There's some case law that I'm not an expert on, or pretend to be, a Dollar Hyde case. It has to do with cities enacting ordinances stricter than state ordinances, especially related to criminal penalties. The whole idea is that a local city or political subdivision would try to ban firearms or do something to that effect. The gun lobby, you know, is opposed to that, and this was an attempt to state case law and still allow the cities to regulate for public safety reasons in areas they'd have a legitimate concern to do so.
Okay, the local jurisdictions have, this doesn't get in the way of our, lo and behold, our 3400, Senate Bill 3400 and our Senate Bill 2282 and all the efforts they've done to try to say nothing we do up here.
Right.
Except as way. Otherwise provided by law, we believe would cover that. Virginia Vanderbilt is here and she has may also be able to speak to this.
Why don't we have Virginia come forward if she's here? If she's not here, Jack will just deal with her comments.
I have a letter from Virginia Vanderbilt that I believe you have, but I can read it at any rate.
Well, I don't think you can read one piece of it if you want. We don't need to read the whole letter, but
in the letter, Virginia says that the section does restrict the ability of entities to pass gun laws. The last paragraph of the letter, however, takes somewhat of a different tenor. The section does, however, allow the entities to regulate the possession of firearms and ammunition in public places. Whether any regulation enacted under that authority is restrictive is probably going to be in the eye of the beholder. It seems to me that the section does allow considerable regulation, although each regulation would have to be evaluated on its own merits to see if it was on possession in a public place.
Okay. If I wasn't listening very well, but let's go through the bill, folks, and give some instructions. We've been discussing with the speaker on an attempt to get Senator Shoemaker has volunteered to sort of be the point person from this committee, and I think we have a volunteer from the House Committee, Representative Mannix, and Jack's going to work with him to try to fix up some of the technical pieces that were overlooked or just didn't have a chance to get down over there. And then we'll bring some, we will see how far they get and have something to look at, and then pass it around to the working group to make sure we haven't done anything that people are really concerned about. I do want to say that for my purposes, I suppose this is a time to highlight some of those issues that I think were important that we went through yesterday. And the other one is, one of them is the definition of a misdemeanor involving violence, to see if we can't be a little more clear what that is and refer to the criminal statutes or whatever statutes we're looking at. And then I think there was some, that's all really basic. I see it on page 2, lines 19, and it kind of goes, I don't know how you do physical force against physical force against property. We need to find out what kind of misdemeanor, what those would actually be, and get some idea of what we're talking about there, and either maybe reference them, maybe not. I just think clean up that definition a little bit to see what. Those are some things that seem to me we need a little work on to be more precise. I think it's interesting that you use biological factors on line 30, but I'm not going to fuss around about that. It's just a funny little thing that may be important to somebody, and I certainly don't want to.
It's important in the sense of an identification system could be a 1-800 dial a felon type of system that would not do what 3470 does as far as with thumbprints.
I'm only talking about biological factors. I'm not talking about other. I'm only talking about the use of the words biological factors that are undefined. And I know that I'm talking about only that inclusion of those words would say undefined somewhere 30 years down the line, these biological factors. Now, I appreciate the fact that we passed the DNA bill, and there will be some things like that you might ultimately want to do, so I don't have strong pieces. I think there are discussions need to take place with respect on page 10, again, to see, to sort of talk about whether you need to flush out the temporary transfer or whether that was enough. The constitutional questions on need to be reviewed with respect to the state law, and that's a policy decision, I guess, too, on D and E. And if we want to do something about E, it seems to me that we could discuss some further qualifications of pretrial release, meaning, and the release officers determine that that you'd be a threat if you had a gun, or same kind of language that we do back here to the judge. Because the release officers are in the business of making decisions, and oftentimes those people actually do see psychiatric social workers or nurses or whatever they are in the intake piece. So that's a piece you might want to look at. I don't know. And
it's my understanding as well, and Jack may know this better, but when you go on pretrial release, don't you have to sign, right? There are certain things that you agree to do and not do.
Well, but that's a choice. It shouldn't be a carte blanche for everyone.
No, but I'm
that's
saying...
That's what I'm saying. It's possible to do that. Certainly, the pre-release officers can require people to do lots of things. And Jack would... Some folks question that goes beyond the constitutionality of what people can require folks to do. But there's a fine line there. Anyway, I think we need to explore that in the committee. Ultimately, needs to sort of visit with the working group and visit with ourselves to see how important those parts are.
Now, I suppose there was lots of questions, technical problems with H and I on that page too, and I thought I wrote technical problem there. And I also wrote a little word that that's also constitutional question needs to be discussed and explored a little bit there. The misdemeanor, I guess there's somebody had flagged the marijuana convictions here on, and I don't know what that, somebody needs to take a relook at that and reaffirm that, I think.
It's in my office 2 weeks ago.
I don't know if anybody else has anything that they want to raise. I'm just sort of going through some things that I wrote down so that we can note for Jack and kind of Shoemaker.
On line 20, when it says in the previous 4 years has been diverted and convicted, would that necessarily be two different offenses, or could you have a diversion and a conviction for a single offense?
It's neither or.
Sure.
Yeah, because diverted and convicted, I don't think it's the same.
You could have an unsuccessful diversion and then a subsequent conviction.
All stemming from the same fact.
Yes.
And if that were true, then that would, the purpose of this is that you have
been diverted
twice.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
Correct.
So we want to be sure that we can't get somebody who's offended once, but has been
successfully diverted once, I think, is, and then convicted once wouldn't qualify.
Yeah, I think we need, there are things people can go back to. On page 15, I've got, we need to discuss more the kind of, and clarify the fact that this must have a license with you at all times to make sure that what, we had that discussion, and we just, that's a clarification part to make it sure Jack raised that. And maybe I wrote it on the wrong page.
We have a question about the temporary transfer of a firearm.
Yeah, I raised that earlier.
Got that.
Madam Chair, if I might, one of the issues that was discussed when the bill had its hearing before Ways and Means, it was raised by the city, and there's legislative record, there's legislative information on this, but that I think needs to be brought in, is on page 14, line 24, and that's not the quite right place to put it, but it has to do with civil and criminal liability attaching to not only sheriffs but local law enforcement agencies when they process the paper.
Yeah. Do you have a copy of that? I have a written piece of paper somewhere that I got from the city. Oh, here it is. Then I'll leave with Jack.
But that was where it was addressed during the hearings in Ways and Means. It certainly was the intent that local law enforcement in processing papers should have that same exemption from liability. That's where the discussion took place. Because of where it comes in the bill, it really deals only with concealed weapons licenses, and so it may not cleanly there, but that was, I think, the issue that was raised and that we had agreed to take care of.
Okay, I want to stop us now and go back to Section 38. I know Senator Springer has some questions, and then Senator Springer and I have a conference committee momentarily. And then I think you can continue to explore, the rest of you, a little bit with the folks and go through some of your questions and get them explored a little bit more. But Section 38, let's go to Section 38 if anybody specifically wants to. Dick, you have questions about the preemption issue?
Yeah, could somebody just tell me what the purpose of this is and who wants it and why?
The purpose of this, Madam Chair, Senator Springer, it results from case law, the Dollar Hyde case, and I don't know the years and all the details behind it, but it basically says local governments cannot enact ordinances with stricter criminal penalties than a state law. And the idea behind that, behind this language, was to A, state case law, and B, address some of the concerns of gun owners that local cities and municipalities would like ban a firearm ownership. This has been agreed to by the cities and the various people representing the gun lobby, and it does come very close, or hopefully does accomplish both goals. It still allows for regulation where cities and local governments would have very viable interest in doing so. for public safety reasons.
Well, just for instance, I'm looking at the definition of public place, which is cross-referenced at 161.015, and you probably have a copy of that before you, but maybe someone more familiar with how that has been construed in the past talks, and it uses this great language which says includes but is not limited to, whatever that means. Premises used in connection with public transportation, would that apply to a bus or MAX? I don't know if places or premises used in connection with public transportation or public passenger transportation.
I wouldn't think it would. Premises normally doesn't mean a vehicle, I don't think.
Virginia may know. She's here.
Well, anybody who can help out.
Good question.
Come on up, Mr. Nichols.
Like I say, I don't know how that language has been construed, if it has been in
my
case
Chair,
law.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Springer, I haven't done a, you know, I could grab the annals and look real quickly. Places.
Yeah. Identify yourself.
Excuse me, Virginia Vanderbilt, Legislative Counsel's Office. And the effect of includes but is not limited to, I believe the effect is it'd be sort of like type places to those things that were limited. I don't know if a court would say that a bus was a place of, you know, public transportation. I think it's arguable.
Language includes but is not limited to is drafting intended to avoid the statutory rule that when you list things, those are the only things to be included. But to have that language, it basically means it could be, it basically means that the following are examples. Okay, well, while we ponder that thought, if anyone has a better answer, Mr. Nichols, can you?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, John Nichols, Oregon State Rifle and Pistol Association. For the record, we did not seek this particular section. We feel that the Dollar High decision would allow us to overturn any local ordinance that we felt was violated the law, rights of law-abiding gun owners. This section was put in because some members on the House wanted it, and here it is. We too find it slightly ambiguous.
Who wanted it?
Representative Dwyer was a person who talked to me a lot.
Okay.
Representative Clark, and who's
well,
here?
Well, it seems to me the National Rifle Association also.
They like the general idea of preemption. They did not specifically pursue this language.
Why don't you ask them?
Okay, well, I know that the NRA's goal for years in previous sessions has been basically to preempt everything at the local level. And so I guess I got to hear how this is going to impact regulations or ordinances such as Portland, which says you can't carry a loaded firearm, period, public or private place. If I understand the city ordinance correctly. Can anybody tell me how that's going to be affected? Or, you know, they also have a provision that says you can't discharge a firearm within the city limits. Now, I know this speaks only possession, but how does the discharge of firearm ordinance affect it?
Kelly, we're talking about the preemption section 38. And so Springer is asking, how this would affect some of the local Portland city ordinances, which don't necessarily have to deal with issuing concealed weapons permits, but other ordinances about how guns are dealt with.
Well, in past sessions, our local law enforcement people have been adamant that they don't want to see the authority of the city, for example, to provide additional protection preempted. And that's what I'm trying to clarify, just what the purpose is and what the effect would be upon ordinance such as those I've cited as it relates to carrying a loaded firearm, public or private place, or discharge of a firearm within city limits.
There may be other examples.
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, for the record, Kelly Clark, State Representative, District 27. And I worked on the subcommittee that put this bill together, and I'm supposed to understand something about it. The preemption language came from a working group which involved the local governments. The language, like a lot of language, is sort of a little bit of this, a little bit of that. My understanding of what this would do would be to say, I think the language itself would say, if I understood one of your examples was TriMet bus.
That was a question about the definition of public place in 161015, and at best I think there's still a little uncertainty as to how that might be affected.
Okay, I don't remember the exact wording of the definition of public place. Off the top of the head, written response would be it certainly would cover the public place. It certainly would cover something like TriMet bus. I think the functional effect of this language is to say that what we have left. First of all, I don't believe that the preemption language in Section 38. Let me phrase it the other way. The state has preempted what the state has preempted by enacting House Bill 3470, if the state does that, if we do that. I think the Dollarhide case and Lodi and a couple of others essentially say that. We have moved in this area. Cities are precluded from at least from the standpoint of criminal law, precluded from moving in similar areas.
Kelly, I want to stop you. I don't know if you worked on 3400. We just passed that on the floor today in a sort of a reduced, took out the more broad language, but it still has language like this that allows pretty broad. So we're doing this in, the purpose of adding it here is to sort of make sure we cover the gun statutes, or to sort of do a backup for 3400 if that didn't pass, or what?
I think the purpose of Section 38 is in fact a limitation on local governments, saying that we're giving them two areas that they can move in, and that is regulation of possession of firearms and ammunition in public places. And those two areas only. And every single example that the cities and counties could raise of where they might be concerned and where they might want to do something extra fell, as far as we could tell, fell under those two phrases. I think the concern of from the other side, the concern of the gun owners was that localities not have the authority essentially to undermine some of the protections written into the bill from the standpoint of the gun owner. So again, it's kind of a balance that we tried to strike there, but that we tried to think of example after example of what might the cities or counties want to do. And regulation of possession of firearms and ammunition in public place seemed to be discharging firearms in a public place within city limits. I think I can make a strong argument that that is covered by this language, that cities and counties would have the authority to do that. Now the one thing that would not be, because we've said except as otherwise provided by law, and because of the preemption case law, my understanding of what the House did was to say, for example, if you have a concealed weapons permit, then you can carry a concealed weapon, despite what a city or county says otherwise, and you can carry that concealed weapon anywhere. And that's the practical effect of having a concealed weapons permit. May not be able to discharge it in a public place, some of those things, but you can carry it. I don't know if that answers your question, Senator. I sort of droned on there, but that's kind of the history of this section as I understand it.
Okay, so discharge, city ordinance in Portland that says you can't discharge a firearm within city limits. I think you said that may not be affected by this language, or would not be affected by this language.
That would be my understanding.
Okay, but the ordinance that says you can't carry a loaded firearm, that would be affected.
Only if you
have a concealed weapon permit and you want to carry your concealed weapon loaded, which I assume most people do.
And again, because that is specifically addressed and preempted by this bill. That is as an area in which the state has said, this is what you have to do in this state to get a concealed weapons permit. If you qualify for a concealed weapons permit in the state, you get a concealed weapons permit. And except as otherwise provided by law would include that. So that would be specifically accepted from the authority of cities and counties to regulate possession of firearms and ammunition.
Just to carry that one step further, I can understand the consistency between the changes in the concealed weapon law and I guess the implied relationship with the city ordinance that limits carrying a loaded firearm. And I guess to the extent a loaded concealed weapon arguably I guess would be preempted, but what about a loaded long gun or rifle or shotgun, which I understand the gripe from gun owners before has been that when they're riding around or going hunting or leaving town or for whatever reason, they may want to have a loaded weapon. I can't imagine why, but...
Well, I can't think of any place in this bill that would preempt a locality from regulating that activity, possession of a firearm in a public place, as it's defined in statute. Again, because you'd have to be able to point to something in this bill that preempts that kind of regulation.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, I guess the House is under call.
Okay, great. Well, we got to go off to a couple of other things, too. Senator Springer, you have...
Is somebody from Portland here?
I think we need to ask. I got a message from Mr. Potter, the Portland Police, supporting it, but I'm not sure he understood all the ramifications. I just think we need to get on with it. Yes.
Madam Chair, if I can add, the City of Portland worked with us. Jackie Bloom worked with us on this language, and they gave us a memo here, and I can provide copies of it to you, that explains what they're currently regulating, and that they did not want to give up any of this regulation and any preemption language. And we worked with them, and they are satisfied with this language that allows them to do what they're currently doing. As far as specific examples, I can't speak to that, but they were comfortable with this, and they have told me that this is it, though. No, you know, no more. This covers it.
But if I may interject.
Yes, please.
What do they say in the memo they do regulate?
They do regulate. There's 4 points. Carrying firearms loaded or unloaded in a park, school, or public building. I'll read it in the memo form for it. May not carry firearm on public street or public place or in vehicle if all ammunition has not been removed from the clip or chamber. May not fire or discharge a firearm within the city boundaries. Person in possession must allow properly identified peace officer to inspect weapon carried upon the person or in the car. The last one was not very really talked about it or addressed. It's kind of vague.
Would your understanding of this preempt that last one?
I'm not sure how it relates exactly to this language as far as allowing someone to inspect a rifle.
It would not.
Yeah, that's...
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, I know that it was discussed in committee the issue of is there an obligation to present your license when you're carrying a weapon. So in actuality, I think it's not inconsistent with the other portions of the statute. If I also might respond to something that Senator Springer raised, Corey is right. There was a lot of discussion with the City of Portland in terms of how this language would impact them. We spent a lot of time looking at the most, particularly the most recent cases, I mean, looking at Lodi as well. And I think that the consensus in the legal community was that Portland could maintain its current statutes and its current ordinances, but that if they went much further, that they would probably be prohibited. If they went into the areas that 3470 was doing, that they couldn't do it, but that their current statutes or ordinance could stay in place. And you will note that these are all public places. And their definitions, I think, are fairly similar.
So is the housing authority a public place?
Depends which part, where within the housing authority it is, but it seems to me that in the discussions in the housing authority, it's federal.
You mean in the public areas of the apartment building, or do you mean in
it's the apartments?
I'm talking about the apartments.
The inside or the outside?
The inside.
No, I don't believe so.
Public place in the statute means a place to which the general public has access.
So it wouldn't, no matter where it is, it would be in here.
But it includes, but it's not limited to hallways, lobbies, and other parts of apartment houses and hotels not constituting rooms or apartments designed for actual residence. So I think that's pretty clear.
Let me, if I may, one further question. I don't know if the discussion with the City of Portland folks touched on this, but let me make sure I understand this correctly. If a person gets a concealed weapon permit, I assume that it's within Portland, which does have a prohibition against carrying a loaded firearm, you know, under any circumstances, I assume, public or private, as I understand the ordinance. Basically, if a person had a concealed weapon permit, they could carry a loaded firearm. Okay. Or carry a concealed weapon about their person. I mean, the concern I have is, you know, the cops say that half the cars in North and Northeast Portland, who knows, maybe Southeast Portland, have got a gun under the front seat or in the jockey box. I mean, it's just kind of, unfortunately, a fact of life. And I'm just trying to learn if a person has a concealed weapon permit, whether carrying a loaded gun under the front seat or in the glove box is going to be permitted, notwithstanding Oregon law, or, pardon me, the City of Portland ordinance.
So long as it complies with the provisions of the new provisions in this act, and again, I mean, unfortunately, you know, Madam Chair and Senator Springer, as you well know, I mean, there are no... This is very gray. I think that the overall intent was to be consistent with what the courts have decided, and not upset the status quo, which people were living with, or upset it to the least amount possible. To address that particular issue, there is a part of the bill now that talks about guns and vehicles and that kind of stuff, and I think that those would override.
My sense is, you know, I'm coming from officer safety, and I mean, it's not the movies where I've seen the officers say, you got a gun in there, or they see something they think is a gun. It's everybody's out of the car. They're not asking if you've got a, you know, little thing with your picture on it. they don't usually stop for that, and I don't think they're going to stop for that either if they think there's a gun in the vehicle. And if I were in their position, I'd be doing the same thing.
What is the provision regarding vehicles?
Page 17, line...